Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. It is the first Wednesday of the month, and it has been our pleasure for a long time on this day to talk about food in this hour of the show. And today we have as our very special guest a cookbook author and food writer who is quite well known for writing about the food of the Mediterranean and the Middle East. Our guest is Claudia Roden. She may be known to some folks for a book that she wrote now something like 40 years ago, her first book, which was The Book of Middle Eastern Food. And for a lot of people, that might have been their first introduction to the kinds of tastes that are important in the cuisine of the Middle East. It's a book that, in fact, she expanded and updated and is still now available, The New Book of Middle Eastern Food, that was just published a few years back. She has a brand new book, which is focused on the cooking of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. This book is Arabesque. It was just published a couple of months ago. It was published officially in November, published by Knopf. It is a beautiful book. I think if you'd like to explore this kind of cooking, it would be a good thing for you to look at. And if you enjoy looking at cookbooks, it's a beautiful book. So you just might like to go down to the bookstore and take a look at the book. She is the author, Claudia Roden is the author of a number of cookbooks. Another that she's well known for is The Book of Jewish Food. She has also written about the cooking of Italy and the Mediterranean. So she has a number of books in print, and I'm sure if you go down to the bookstore, you can find them. She's joining us this morning by telephone. She makes her home in London, and she is in England. And we're very pleased to have her with us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, by the way, if there are people who are listening would like to call in, the number to call, if you are here where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, it's 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Ms. Roden, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. It is a beautiful book. I think sometimes I just like looking at cookbooks just to if they're beautifully done, to look at the food, to read the recipes, then it's a bonus if you actually go out and make something from the book. But I think just I'm one of those people who just likes to look at cookbooks, and I think it's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
What was it that led you to want to concentrate particularly on the food of these three countries, Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon?
Well, because my publishers. Really, it is because over all these years, it is now almost 45 years that I've been collecting recipes from the Middle East. And it is almost 40 years when I started publishing. But I kept on and on collecting, either because I travel or because people, wherever I go, know that those who come from the Middle East and North Africa know that is what I do. They give me recipes. And so I just carried on collecting. And then my publishers asked me to do a book of the best three cuisines in the area. And I chose those three because they were the best. Syria and also Iran are as good and are marvelous, but somehow my publishers thought, no, not them. But, these also had something in common. They had a lot in common. That's why they could go in one book, although they're separated like three different parts. They go together, and you can take dishes from one and from the other for the same meal, partly because they are, being around the Mediterranean, they are part of the Mediterranean culture, and they have that in common. There is a type of style that we recognize as Mediterranean. But they also, all of them have influences from ancient Baghdad, for instance, with the arrival of Islam because these countries are not entirely Islamic. Morocco is and Turkey is, but Lebanon, of course, is at least half Christian. But still, there is this Islamic style of cooking that has come into the three countries. Morocco is more different than, is rather a bit separate from Lebanon and Turkey. Lebanon and Turkey were part of the Ottoman Empire. In fact, Turkey was the center of the Ottoman Empire, and that has caused quite a lot of similarities. Whereas Morocco has differences in that, well, it was never part of the empire, although it did have some influences through immigrants coming from Tunisia and Algeria who were part of the empire, but also because it had such close, very close links with Spain, in fact, with Al-Andalus, which was Muslim Spain. And that has given them a very, very special and different character added to the ones that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps we could talk a little bit more about each of the sort of the essential elements of each of these cuisines. Certainly, as you say, they do share some things in common, perhaps the use of certain kinds of vegetables, of pulses, of olive oil. That's probably one thing that,
yeah,
that would be the basic oil that they would all use. Perhaps the thing that sets Morocco apart particularly is the use of certain spices, things like saffron and,
yes,
cinnamon, which is often paired with some kind of fruit in a meat stew, in a tagine, which is sort of the famous Moroccan,
yes,
stew, which is, that's, I think that's probably going to be, if people have had some exposure to the food, maybe that's the thing that they're going to
think of,
and they might well have had.
Well, let's say Turkey. I should say that one reason that they have such a grand, why they are so good compared to other countries. For instance, Morocco is a lot better than Tunisia and Algeria, and Lebanon is a lot better than Egypt. I shouldn't say this because I'm Egyptian of origin. But the reason was that they were capitals, or rather they were centers of empire. And because of that, there was, in a way, concentration of foods and styles from different parts of the empire, but also court cuisines that where they elaborated special dishes. Now, Turkey, really in Egypt, because Egypt was part of the Ottoman Empire, our haute cuisine was Turkish, and a lot of our aristocracy was Turkish as well. Some of the differences are the use of aromatics, and you mentioned cinnamon and ginger, cinnamon and saffron in Morocco. Well, in Turkey, they use cinnamon and allspice for meat dishes, for meatball, for various meat dishes. They also use, just thinking of one red spice, which suddenly escapes my mind, but it'll come in a minute. But they use also flavorings like mastic, which Morocco doesn't use, and Lebanon does. They use pomegranate molasses for all kinds of dishes, including meats. They also use a lot of, they use different herbs. They use mint. They use, with their fish, fennel and dill. And the Moroccans really use mint and fresh cilantro. I say coriander because that's what we say in Britain, but it's cilantro, lots of it. They all use parsley. They all like garlic, but in Istanbul, for instance, They don't like garlic. They see themselves as very sophisticated and very different from the rest of Turkey. I think I can say, I should say now that the countries, although can say some things in general, they are very, very varied regionally. And every town almost has its specialities. And for instance, Istanbul is very sophisticated, the cooking there, sophisticated and refined, and not with no very strong flavors. They certainly wouldn't put garlic or chili. Whereas in a part of Turkey, a city called Gaziantep, they put lots of chili, lots of garlic, and they are very different. So it is difficult to say what each country is, but I should say in general, the food of Turkey, the basic staples are bulgur in the countryside. Bulgur is cracked wheat. In Lebanon, they call it burhul, and that is the food, the general staple of the mountains and the countryside. Whereas in the cities, the staple is rice. In Morocco, the staple is couscous. It is wheat, of course, and it's a kind of fine semolina, and that is cooked differently from the others. Well, in Turkey and Lebanon, they use a lot of yogurt. It is very much part of the of many of their dishes, either as a side dish or even to cook with. They even cook meats in yogurt. There are things like, for instance, there is a kind of sauce that is made, particularly in Turkey, that is egg and lemon sauce. You find it in Greece as well, also in Egypt. Those kinds of things that you find in Turkey, because of the empire, you find it in very many countries. A great part of the Mediterranean and the Middle East was part of the Ottoman Empire. There is something also which is there very common, is stuffed vegetables, and the vegetables are usually aubergines, courgettes, tomatoes, peppers, even onions. I'm not sure whether you want me to go on too much.
Well, let me, perhaps what I should do is introduce you again to people who are listening. We might have some folks who have tuned in since the beginning. Our guest is food writer Claudia Roden. She's the author of a number of cookbooks about the cooking of the Mediterranean and also of the Middle East. Her newest book is Arabesque, which features the cooking of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. This book has just now been out for a couple of months, and I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. It's a beautiful book. It's published by Knopf. Perhaps some people will also know her for her book of Jewish food or the book of Middle Eastern food. That was one that was her very, very first book, was published some years ago, but recently has been updated and now is available in hardcover. It's the new book of Middle Eastern food. So if you're interested in exploring these tastes, you can go to the bookstore, go to the library, look for her books, and experiment, try some of the recipes. Also, if you'd like to call in, if you'd like to talk with our guest, Claudia Roden, 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Our guest, Claudia Roden, was born in Cairo and grew up there. As a teenager, she went to school in Paris and then moved to London, and has now traveled quite a lot and has done a lot of writing. In fact, has won a number of awards for her work. I do want to mention that the Book of Jewish Food won a James Beard Award, and that's a good thing. It's not everybody that can say that. She has also written some books about the cooking of Italy, and she's talking with us from London, where she lives. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone who would like to talk with you, so let us do that. This is someone in Kankakee, and it is line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
The guest's book is filled with visually stunning photographs, which, along with the recipes, produce a most tempting presentation of these cuisines. Your caller cannot help but wonder over the fact that he finds nothing in the book concerning the meat of goat. Is not goat meat a part of the cuisines of Morocco, Turkey,
yes,
and Lebanon?
Yes, it is. A kid is very much. I didn't include a recipe myself, because it isn't something that is easily found in Britain and in America.
It's interesting the caller mentioned that, because it's something that I have always been a little bit curious about, never having eaten it. I would guess that it might be something like lamb, but maybe it's different. What is goat like? Does it compare with lamb?
It does, and a young goat, a kid, is what is eaten.
Mm-hmm.
An old goat is pretty tough and not particularly nice.
So I suppose
you have to stew it a long, long time, and then it would be even then dry and stringy.
Mm. So I suppose if you wanted to get something like that kind of a taste, you could use lamb, and that would it would get
yes.
you close.
Yes, but close. Certainly baby goat is a delicacy.
I wanted to have you talk a little bit about the Moroccan tagine, and in part because this dish takes its name from the characteristic pot that it's cooked in.
Yes.
And I'm sure that if people really want to, they can go out and they can buy a tagine. I have certainly seen them around here for sale. But I expect that probably to make a tagine, to make that kind of stew, you really don't need to have one of these cooking pots.
No. I mean, those cooking pots are extremely good, especially for cooking over the dying coals of a fire outdoors. Or else in a courtyard. That's when they cooked quite a bit in the courtyards of houses. Because it gives a very all-round heat, a very low heat, it is a clay pot and it's got this conical lid, and that it does create a sort of very slow and all-round heat, gentle heat, and where you can cook something for a long time. You don't need much water. You put very little water, and it cooks very slowly. Now, I found when I've been going back that some people are using a pressure cooker, which I don't want to use myself, but they do. The thing is that now women work, and they haven't got time to cook as they used to. And young people, this is what they do. But yes, you can cook it in a casserole. You can cook it in. You need a thick-bottomed pan, otherwise, or a casserole, mm. because you don't want the bottom to burn, because it is a long cooking, and. The idea is that you don't want too much water. It's not a liquid stew. It is more of a braise.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that it is the variety of dishes that are called tagines. Tagines, there are all kinds of tagines. There are some that are, for instance, the most famous one is chicken with preserved lemon and olives. And the same one, there are many versions. One is with artichoke bottoms, and one is with fennel. But it has ginger, and it has saffron. It has sometimes it could be with turmeric, and that is one of the flavors of the tagines. It also has cilantro and parsley. Preserved lemons, this is one of the flavorings that is just North African, that Morocco has separate from the others. And it is a country that uses olives for cooking, in cooking. The others don't. They eat the olives separately, but they don't cook with them. Now, there is a different kind of tagine that that can be with ginger, cinnamon, as you said, and saffron. And sometimes these tagines are sweet with a bit of honey. And that's terribly, to me, a wonderful flavor. Mm-hmm. Those tagines can be either with lamb, which is the usual meat, or with chicken. And they sometimes, and or very often, have blanched almonds thrown in, and or else sesame seeds at the last minute. So they're extremely aromatic.
There are a number of recipes and that looked to me look good that are lamb tagine and has some kind of sweet element to it in addition to the ginger and cinnamon. There's one with that uses pears. There's one that uses apricots, one that uses quince, one with dates, one with prunes. So each it's a different fruit, but it's that combination of it's a little bit sweet, it's a little bit savory, and does indeed have these key flavors in there that certainly they have. I think all of those recipes have cinnamon in them.
Not all.
Not all.
Though some, because some have the lemony ones wouldn't have cinnamon.
Not the ones with preserved lemon certainly would not have.
Because there are are some that are red. Red in color because they've got cumin and paprika. They wouldn't have cinnamon, and so there are these different types of groupings of spices.
I guess that there is a very in Moroccan cooking. There is a very kind of signature combination of flavor that's used a lot. That is the combination of the olives and the preserved lemon.
Yes.
And it's interesting. Last night, my wife and I were talking about the fact that we had made something within the last year or so, we had made something with preserved lemon, except now we couldn't remember what it was. But the thing that we did was we're lucky in our community here. We have a number of international kind of grocery stores where you can buy the kinds of ingredients that you need. And so we went and we actually went out and bought preserved lemons and had to buy a very large jar of them. Most of them we didn't end up using. But what interested me about the book is that you say it's not that hard. You can make your own, and in fact, you have a recipe here for doing the preserved lemon, where if you can take the time, you have to essentially what they are. They're pickled lemons, so you can do it and take several weeks. But you also have a way of doing it that only takes
very
a couple
quick.
Of days.
Yes.
Maybe you could. Can you share that recipe for the quick preserved lemon?
Let me see. The quick preserved lemons. Yes. Because they are basically preserved in salt. That first of all, you have to make incisions in the skin from one end of the lemon to the other. You put the lemons then in a large pan with salted water, about a lot of salt, 4 tablespoons for 4 lemons, for instance, and you cover them with water. And then you put the lid on, and you put also a plate, a small lid, to hold them down because they float. And then you simmer. You cook them for 25 minutes. And then when they're cool, you scoop out the flesh. You don't eat the flesh. And you pack the skins in a glass jar, and you cover them with vegetable oil or sunflower oil or olive oil, but actually they actually use peanut oil or groundnut oil. Mm-hmm. And so there you are. You can just make them, and you can even use them straight away, which I do. So they are easy to make, and they are very good. like that.
So here now, and just to make sure people understand what part of the lemon you're using the colored part, the zest, but you're also using the rind, the pithy, the white
yes.
stuff that's in there. What you just want is to scoop out, apparently scoop out everything else.
From the inside.
From
but
the inside.
The whole peel that you can
yeah.
use.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe something of what sort of flavor that you get?
Well, it is lemony but mellow. It's not sharp. It's sort of subdued kind of sharp.
Hmm. And maybe then you could you mentioned the fact that there is apparently a key sort of a signature Moroccan dish that's the chicken with olives and preserved lemon. Can you just
yes.
just and I don't think it's a very complicated recipe. I'm here sort of trying to I know it's right here.
Yeah.
You could just kind of sketch out what the recipe how the recipe goes.
Yeah. Let me see. Yes, well, you saute the chicken pieces in this pan and then you stir in some garlic, some saffron, some ginger. In this one, I don't seem to have put onions because onions come in very often, but here it doesn't. Actually, it is better to stir in the spices in the oil with the garlic before you put the chicken pieces in. Then you put them in. You add salt and pepper, and you cover with a bit of water so that they're covered. And then you start cooking. You lift out the breasts after about 20 minutes so that they don't cook too, because they cook quicker than the legs. And you continue cooking. And in this one, I've also got some lemon juice as well as the preserved lemons. And so you add lemon juice, parsley, and cilantro, and the preserved lemon peel, which is cut into quarters or into strips, and the olives. And then you simmer for another 5 or 10 minutes until the sauce is reduced and unctuous. And then towards the end, you put back the chicken breasts so that they heat up again.
Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds pretty good to me, and that's a recipe that I think is actually not terribly not complicated at all, and doesn't call for. I think the only thing in here that people might find difficult to find if they decided that they wanted to try to make it would be the preserved lemons, and even there, if you really want to make it, you can make your own.
Yeah, and they can even they can make them just before.
Mm-hmm. And apparently, if you would like to have a little heat in that, you could put a little hot chili in there.
You could. Let's say the Moroccans are not so hot in their taste. It is the Tunisians who, and also the Algerians, who like, who put chili more. And some people, especially those who travel to France, to Paris, a lot of the dishes that they eat there, the tagines and the couscous, are more Tunisian and Algerian, so we are used to more chili.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly, as I say, it sounds very good to me, and this is apparently a very well-known Moroccan chicken dish. Not difficult, I would think, not difficult at all to cook, and if people want to try it, this is the tagine of chicken with preserved lemon and olives, and it is one of the recipes in Claudia Roden's newest book, Arabesque. It's A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon, and it's published by Knopf. She's the author of a number of cookbooks. People perhaps will know her for her book of Middle Eastern food. That book was updated and expanded and is now available as the new book of Middle Eastern food. That's out there. She has authored a number of books about Mediterranean cooking, a number of books about the cooking of Italy, and perhaps also you would know her for the book of Jewish food, which came out a few years back and won a James Beard Award. And she is talking with us from where she lives in England, and questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I do want to have you talk a little bit also about couscous, and I have to admit, you know, I've tried to make couscous, and somehow It's all my efforts have failed. I'm not sure what it is that I am doing wrong, because I've just never been happy with the result.
Right. I think a lot of people tell me that. And what I think the reason is that all the couscous that we buy is pre-cooked couscous. It is not the couscous that the traditional way where people had to cook it, steam it for 3/4 of an hour and keep adding water and steaming and keep adding moistening and steaming. And what happens, I personally find that it is much more difficult to steam couscous and get it to work than to just put it in the oven. And I did go to a couscous factory in Tunisia, where they showed us how to make the traditional way and all the traditional dishes. And then they were telling us how people cooked the couscous when it is pre-cooked. And a lot of people use the pre-cooked one in North Africa, in Morocco. Also, the people from North Africa who live in France, a lot of them do. I've seen them using that. Now, he was saying people here still do steaming because it's the tradition and they're used to tradition. But actually, the best way, he said, you can put it in the oven. You can even put it in the microwave. And the basic thing, you also have a good way of, you can make it perfect, even if it's a pre-cooked couscous, by just adding the same amount of water as the volume of couscous. You can measure it and just put the same volume. And then you let it absorb, mix it in, and mix it in a bit with a fork. And then you add a little bit of oil. It depends. It's usually 2 tablespoons of oil. And the trick to make it a perfect couscous is to rub it. And to rub it and drop it from on high. It means you take some between your palms, you rub it, and you let it fall again so that it lets air in, and also so that it crushes any lumps. And then you can just put it in the oven. You can either cover it with foil. Actually, you don't even need to cover it with foil, because you only want it to heat through. Because it is already cooked, it doesn't need cooking. It needs heating through. And I always make it in a big clay dish, because I always make it when we are quite a few people and I want to make quite a lot. And I put it in the dish, which is going to go straight to the table. So it is just the easiest possible thing to do, and also the easiest possible thing to do perfectly well. You don't need to be a great cook. You just need to put the same amount of water, a little bit of salt, and a little bit of oil, and rub it well, and then you heat it through. And at the same time, you are making your soupy meat and vegetable stew. It's really more a soup than a stew, but it has lots of different vegetables. It has meat. It has usually chickpeas as well. Yes, I think that's all there is to it. But when you take your couscous out, you put in some butter and melt it in. And that gives it a nice succulent sort of flavor and texture.
All right. Well, I'll have to try that and try your method and see how I do. And maybe I'll finally be successful. We'll see.
I think I might be criticized by purists to tell you that you can do that, which I sometimes am criticized. But the thing is, this works better when actually you have the pre-cooked variety. It's better cooked that way than than the way you cook the couscous that isn't pre-cooked.
You talked a little bit earlier about when you were kind of giving a summary about the different cuisines and what are some of the key elements, and talked about the fact that this as now we have discussed in the cooking of Morocco, the staple, the thing would be couscous, which we just talked about, which is, I guess, I don't know, is it correct to say it's kind of a pasta, or is that really not?
I don't think so. You could say it's a kind of a pasta, but it's tiny, tiny grains. So it would be such tiny pasta. But it is made with durum wheat.
It's the same kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is the same wheat. So it has... but it is so fine. And then it absorbs. It absorbs and the stock of the soupy side part, because you call a couscous the whole thing. The grain is a couscous, but you also call the whole dish, which is this soupy stock with lots of meat, lots of vegetables, and actually there's not just that. There are many, many kinds of couscous. Some of them are, for instance, some lamb cooked with baby onions until they're caramelized and with raisins. So that is something quite different. And you can do a couscous with baby squabs as well. And you would put then in the couscous, you could put raisins and almonds. There are also sweet dishes of couscous that are a dessert, where you would put various dried fruits like dates and apricots and nuts and things.
The staple in the cooking of Lebanon and Turkey is bulgur. This is a grain. It's cracked wheat. And this is, and maybe also the kind of thing that at this point now, people will here in the United States will be familiar with it. May have in fact cooked with it. Maybe you could just give us a couple of suggestions about what to do with bulgur.
Yes. Well, in Lebanon, there is the most famous bulgur dish is. Or rather, bulgur salad. It's a salad called tabbouleh. So you probably know it in America quite well. Mm-hmm. In Britain, we can get it in supermarkets. It was a mountain dish. It is a meze, actually. A meze is a little dish that you have with drinks. Or else little appetizers. And it is a meze, and it is a meze that was actually originated in the mountains in the Bekaa Valley. When it originated, it was a bulgur dish with quite a lot of bulgur and parsley and mint and spring onions and tomatoes. And it's become... the most famous Lebanese or Arab food now through the Lebanese restaurants now all over the world because they have come to represent Arab food. But in the restaurants, it's become something that has very little bulgur and lots of parsley and mint. So it's more parsley salad. But I found what I was looking for in this new book was to find some dishes and that were different from the ones that we know already, that we know especially those through the Lebanese restaurants. And one of them is called safsouf, and it is a mix of bulgur and chickpeas. In this case, I said you can use chickpeas from a tin if it is a good quality. And it is, in this case, you don't have to cook. You just add water and let it become tender. And then you add garlic, lemon juice, salt, pepper, olive oil, and then the chickpeas. And that is then, and then it also has the herbs, the parsley and the mint, but it is a more substantial salad than tabbouleh. Although I do have tabbouleh in the book because people would get very mad at me if I didn't have it. And the Turks have their version of cracked wheat salad, which is, let me see what it is called. I'm working now on the food of Spain, and suddenly all my, I'm thinking of Spain and Spanish dishes every minute. And so some words escape me. It is called kisia, and it is much hotter because it's got chili, than the bulgur salad in here it is. Mm-hmm. It is peppery bulgur salad, and there it's got tomato paste in it. It's got chili pepper. It's got tomatoes. It also has the parsley and the mint and spring onions and tomatoes. But the difference is more that it's got tomato paste, which makes the bulgur look pink, and it's got chili pepper. Now, they also use bulgur. For these salads, they use a fine type of bulgur, and we can get it in London, and you can get it in America, but maybe you can't get it everywhere in America. So you can use the ordinary bulgur for that. Another food that is made with bulgur is various pilafs, and they're easier to make even than rice pilafs, and they are so good. I think this is something that people could adopt, and I would like to encourage them to adopt. And there is, for instance, a pilaf which is that is eaten with roast chicken, and it is a bulgur and walnut pilaf. And in this case, it is cooked, but it needs hardly any cooking because it is also wheat. The bulgur is wheat that has been cooked. They did that in the villages and then dried on the rooftops and then cracked, or it cracks when it is cooked. But now it's done industrially, of course, and you would get the industrial kind. But really, all you need to do is to add water and just enough that you need, and you start heating it. It needs a few minutes cooking. But in this case, you've got fried onions. You've got a flavoring of cinnamon, allspice, salt and pepper, and then you've got walnuts as well. And to finish, they put quite a bit of butter, small pieces of butter, to melt in. So it's an easy thing. Mm-hmm. Instead of water, you can add chicken stock, and you can use it by using bouillon cubes. I must say that I wanted in this book to make things easy. In my first book, I was interviewing people 45 years ago, and they were giving me recipes that their grandmother had, which means about 100 years ago. And now I feel I want to make things easy and to cook the way I cook, but also they cook, because everybody now wants to make life easier for themselves, because in Turkey, women work. In Lebanon, they work. And I have been into people's home and into restaurants, and I can see they put in a stock cube, a bouillon cube, so we can do it too.
Yeah. Well, and I think that as you say, and I think one of the nice things about the book is that most of the ingredients should be readily available, particularly if people do live in a place where they have some kind of grocery where they can – there may be something that they can't just buy in the regular supermarket. They might have to go to a kind of international or Middle Eastern grocery, but I think a lot of communities have them now. So
yeah.
I think most of these recipes are things that people should – they're not that complicated, and the key ingredients should be available.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be a matter of people looking at the recipe and thinking, gee, that sounds good, but I don't know where I will get,
exactly,
you know, whatever it, you know, where I would get prepared lemons.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
I mean, I'm just looking at one next to, well, it's a pilaf with rice, and it's got pine nuts and raisins. Almost every ingredient from the chickpeas and the kinds of things, everything I think, except for maybe three or four things that are in the book that you have to go and look for.
We have a caller here I'd like to bring into the conversation, and
yeah,
maybe about 5 minutes left, so we want to make sure that we do that. This is someone listening in Salem, Illinois, and that is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Is the caller there on line 4? Henry, I'm not hearing the caller.
Well.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I think we got you now. Go ahead.
Yes, well, I'm calling from Charleston.
Oh, Charleston. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
well, go ahead.
Well,
my apologies. Please go ahead.
I just want to compliment you, David, on a great show. The food, you know, is universal, and your guest sounds just exotic. But I only had a comment that on a trip to Washington, D.C., you know, the typical Midwesterners are meat and potatoes, and salty at that. And when I were there, we sampled Ethiopian food that served on the tray and, you know, bits of bread, and you'd pick the food up and all. And I just remember the experience real well. It's been 15 years ago, but it just piques my curiosity, and the food that your guest has been describing, you know, totally foreign to me, but it is one of those things that excites one to try something different. But I just want to congratulate you and your guests, and it's a great show.
Oh, well, go
ahead.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it. Well, I would certainly hope that people listening would say, if they have not tried this kind of food, they would say, well, maybe there's something there that sounds good, and they would try something new. I always like to try things that are new and get new tastes. And I think, you know, particularly to me, for some reason, I'm not exactly sure why, but particularly I think to me the Moroccan dishes sound really good.
Yeah.
I on New Year's Eve, we in our house, we made a lamb stew that had this kind of similar feeling to it. It was not, I'm sure, an authentic North African dish.
Yeah.
But it was a lamb stew that combined some dried fruits. It had dried apricot, prune, and apple. It had cinnamon and clove in it. It had, butternut squash. And I thought it was pretty good. So, you know, that's, I guess I'm already primed to some of these flavors. And I think that now we're going to have to go out and again, get some more preserved lemon, I think, and try the preserved lemon and olives, chicken tagine, and maybe some of these lamb, tagine, because in our house, we really do like lamb as well.
Yes. Well, I found, because I was on a book tour, and I met a lot of chefs around, and I can see that a lot of chefs use much of the kind of tastes and the kind of themes and the kind of partnering of vegetables and things that are in the book already. It is somehow something that has been adopted by chefs I found in Washington, in New York, all over, and some of them, they cooked out of this book a whole meal for a special dinner when people came. But they had been cooking like that for a while. So I feel it isn't something completely new,
mm-hmm,
that it has become part of the eclectic cooking of America already.
And now I know that you're working on a new book, and this is Cooking of Spain, and
yeah,
I would guess that again, because it's a Mediterranean, it has some of the, at least in,
yeah,
I'm sure in southern Spain, it has some Mediterranean influence, that there would be some things that I guess the thing that I think of is as saffron.
Is
a taste that you do see there. I would think that that maybe there would actually be some things that some of the Spanish cooking would share.
Well, exactly. I mean, because certainly the Arabs were there until the 17th century. Although they had to give over, they were they conquered the whole of Spain almost, and then gradually it was reconquered by the Christian kings. But they stayed in Andalusia for nearly 8 centuries, but then they were allowed to stay. They had to leave if they wanted to, but they were told they could stay. But after a few years, they were forced to convert, and they wanted the Christian, Spain wanted them to stay because they were the ones who knew how to do the agriculture and the rice fields and the planting of vegetables. They did want them to stay for all kinds of reasons. And so they were allowed to stay as converted Christians until the 17th century. So from the 8th century to the 17th century, that's a long, long time. Yeah. And they had a lot of time to have a big influence. And some of the influences that I was mentioned from medieval Baghdad, for instance, like the meat and fruit dishes and some of the spice mixtures and some of the mixing of ingredients like chickpeas with spinach and the aubergines and artichokes and a lot of these things you can find all through Spain. And certainly in Catalonia, there is a dish of an apple mixed stuffed with minced pork. In Iran, even before Islam, there was an apple stuffed with minced lamb.
Well, you know, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we've used our time. For people who would like to explore these tastes, you certainly should look for the book Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon by our guest Claudia Roden. It's just recently out. It's published by Knopf. You might also look at some of her other books, including the new book of Middle Eastern food, the book of Jewish food, and also Claudia Roden's Food of Italy. All of those are out there available in the bookstore. Ms. Roden, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.